And how could they develop a rash from a totally benign leaf? The new thought that the leaf wouldn't hurt them overrode their memory and belief that they were allergic to it, rendering real poison ivy harmless. And the reverse was true in the second part of the experiment. A harmless leaf was made toxic by thought alone. In both cases, it seemed as if the children's bodies instantaneously responded to a new mind. In this instance, we could say that the children were somehow freed from the future expectation of a physical reaction to the toxic leaf, based on their past experiences of being allergic. In effect, they somehow transcended a predictable line of time. This also suggests that by some means, they became greater than the conditions in their environment, the poison ivy leaf. Finally, the children were able to alter and control their physiology by simply changing a thought. This astonishing evidence that thought, in the form of expectation, could have a greater effect on the body than the real physical environment helped to usher in a new era of scientific study called psychoneuroimmunology, the effect of thoughts and emotions on the immune system, an important segment of the mind-body connection. Another notable nocebo study from the 60s looked at people with asthma. Researchers gave 40 asthma patients inhalers containing nothing but water vapor, although they told the subjects that the inhalers contain an allergen or irritant. 19 of them, 48%, experienced asthmatic symptoms, such as restriction of their airwaves, with 12, 30% of the group, suffering full-blown asthmatic attacks. Researchers then gave the subjects inhalers said to contain medicine that would relieve their symptoms, and in each case, their airways did indeed open back up. Although again, the inhalers contained only water vapor. In both situations, bringing on the asthma symptoms and then dramatically reversing them, the patients were responding to suggestion alone, the thought planted in their minds by the researchers, which played out exactly as they expected. They were harmed when they thought they'd inhaled something harmful, and they got better when they thought they were receiving medicine. And these thoughts were greater than their environment, greater than reality. We could say that their thoughts created a brand new reality. What does this say about the beliefs we hold and the thoughts we think every day? Are we more susceptible to catching the flu because all winter long, everywhere we look, we see articles about flu season and signs about flu shot availability, all of which reminds us that if we don't get a flu shot, we'll get sick? Could it be that when we simply see someone with flu-like symptoms, we become ill from thinking in the same ways as the children in the poison ivy study, who got a rash from the inert leaf, or from thinking like the asthmatics who experienced a significant bronchial reaction after inhaling simple water vapor? Are we more likely to suffer from arthritis, stiff joints, poor memory, flagging energy, and decreased sex drive as we age, simply because that's the version of the truth that ads, commercials, television shows, and media reports bombard us with? What other self-fulfilling prophecies are we creating in our minds without being aware of what we're doing? And what inevitable truths can we successfully reverse simply through thinking new thoughts and choosing new beliefs? A groundbreaking study in the late 70s showed for the first time that a placebo could trigger the release of endorphins, the body's natural painkillers, just as certain active drugs do. In the study, John Levine, MD, PhD, of the University of California, San Francisco, gave placebos instead of pain medication to 40 dental patients who had just had their wisdom teeth removed. Not surprisingly, because the patients thought they were getting medicine that would indeed relieve their pain, most reported relief. But then the researchers gave the patients an antidote to morphine called naloxone, which chemically blocks the receptor sites for both morphine and endorphins, endogenous morphine, in the brain. When the researchers administered it, the patient's pain returned. This proved that by taking the placebos, the patients had been creating their own endorphins, their own natural pain relievers. It was a milestone in placebo research because it meant that the relief the study subjects experienced wasn't all in their minds. It was in their minds and their bodies, in their state of being. If the human body can act like its own pharmacy producing its own pain drugs, then might it not also be true that it's fully capable of dispensing other natural drugs when they're needed from the infinite blend of chemicals and healing compounds it houses? Drugs that act just like the ones doctors prescribe, or maybe even better than the drugs doctors prescribe. Another study in the 70s, this one by psychologist Robert Ader, PhD, at the University of Rochester, added a fascinating new dimension to the placebo discussion: the element of conditioning. Conditioning, an idea made famous by Russian physiologist Ivan Pavlov, depends on associating one thing with another, like Pavlov's dogs associating the sound of the bell with food after Pavlov started ringing it every day before he fed them. In time, the dogs were conditioned to automatically salivate in anticipation of a meal whenever they heard a bell. As a result of this type of conditioning, their bodies became trained to physiologically respond to a new stimulus in the environment, in this case the bell, even without the original stimulus that elicited the response, the food being present. Therefore, in a conditioned response, we could say that a subconscious program, which is housed in the body, I'll talk more about this in the coming chapters, seemingly overrides the conscious mind and takes charge. In this way, the body is actually conditioned to become the mind, because conscious thought is no longer totally in control. In the case of Pavlov, the dogs were repeatedly exposed to the smell, sight, and taste of the food, and then Pavlov rang a bell. Over time, just the sound of the bell caused the dogs to automatically change their physiological and chemical state without thinking about it consciously. Their autonomic nervous system, the body's subconscious system that operates below the conscious awareness, took over. So conditioning creates subconscious internal changes in the body by associating past memories with the expectation of internal effects, what we call associative memory, until those expected or anticipated end results automatically occur. The stronger the conditioning, the less conscious control we have over these processes, and the more automatic the subconscious programming becomes. Ada started out attempting to study how long such conditioned responses could be expected to last. He fed lab rats saccharin-sweetened water that he'd spiked with a drug called cyclophosphamide, which causes stomach pain. After conditioning the rats to associate the sweet taste of the water with the ache in their gut, he expected they'd soon refuse to drink the spiked water. His intention was to see how long they'd continue to refuse the water, so that he could measure the amount of time their conditioned response to the sweet water would last. But what Ada didn't know initially was that the cyclophosphamide also suppresses the immune system. So he was surprised when his rats started unexpectedly dying from bacterial and viral infections. Changing gears in his research, he continued to give the rats saccharin water, force-feeding them with an eyedropper, but without the cyclophosphamide. Although they were no longer receiving the immune-suppressing drug, the rats continued to die of infections, while the control group that had received only the sweetened water all along continued to be fine. Teaming up with University of Rochester immunologist Nicholas Cohen, PhD, Ada further discovered that when the rats had been conditioned to associate the taste of the sweetened water with the effect of the immune-suppressing drug, the association was so strong that just drinking the sweetened water alone produced the same physiological effect as the drug, signaling the nervous system to suppress the immune system. Like Sam Lond, whose story was in Chapter 1, Ada's rats died by thought alone. Researchers were beginning to see that the mind was clearly able to subconsciously activate the body in several powerful ways they'd never imagined. By this time, the Eastern practice of transcendental meditation, TM, taught by Indian guru Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, had caught on in the United States, fueled by the enthusiastic participation of several celebrities, starting with the Beatles in the 1960s. The goal of this technique, which involves quieting the mind and repeating a mantra during a 20-minute meditation session performed twice a day, is spiritual enlightenment. But the practice caught the attention of Harvard cardiologist Herbert Benson, who became interested in how it might help reduce stress and lessen the risk factors for heart disease. Demystifying the process, Benson developed a similar technique which he called the relaxation response, described in his 1975 book by the same title. Benson found that just by changing their thought patterns, people could switch off the stress response, thereby lowering blood pressure, normalizing heart rate, and attaining deep states of relaxation. While meditation involves maintaining a neutral attitude, attention was also being paid to the beneficial effects of cultivating a more positive attitude and pumping up positive emotions. The way had been paved in 1952 when former minister Norman Vincent Peale published the book The Power of Positive Thinking, which popularized the idea that our thoughts can have a real effect, both positive and negative, on our lives. That idea grabbed the attention of the medical community in 1976, when political analyst and magazine editor Norman Cousins published an account in the New England Journal of Medicine of how he had used laughter to reverse a potentially fatal disease. Cousins also told his story in his best-selling book Anatomy of an Illness, published a few years later. Cousins' doctor had diagnosed him with a degenerative disorder called ankylosing spondylitis, a form of arthritis that causes the breakdown of collagen, the fibrous proteins that hold our body's cells together, and had given him only a 1 in 500 chance of recovery. Cousins suffered from tremendous pain and had such difficulty moving his limbs that he could barely turn over in bed. Grainy nodules appeared under his skin, and at his lowest point, his jaw nearly locked shut. Convinced that a persistent negative emotional state had contributed to his illness, he decided it was equally possible that a more positive emotional state could reverse the damage. While continuing to consult with his doctor, Cousins started a regimen of massive doses of vitamin C and Marx Brothers movies, as well as other humorous films and comedy shows. He found that 10 minutes of hearty laughter gave him 2 hours of pain-free sleep. Eventually, he made a complete recovery. Cousins quite simply laughed himself to health. How? Although scientists at the time didn't have any way to understand or explain such a miraculous recovery, research now tells us it's likely that epigenetic processes were at work. Cousins' shift of attitude changed his body chemistry, which altered his internal state, enabling him to program new genes in new ways. He simply downregulated, or turned off, the genes that were causing his illness, and upregulated, or turned on, the genes responsible for his recovery. I'll go into more detail about turning genes on and off in the coming chapters. Many years later, research by Keiko Hayashi, PhD, of the University of Tsukuba in Japan, showed the same thing. In Hayashi's study, diabetic patients watching an hour-long comedy program upregulated a total of 39 genes, 14 of which were related to natural killer cell activity. While none of these genes were directly involved in blood glucose regulation, the patient's blood glucose levels were better controlled than after they had listened to a diabetic health lecture on a different day. Researchers surmise that laughter influences many genes involved with immune response, which in turn contributed to the improved glucose control. The elevated emotion, triggered by the patient's brains, turned on the genetic variations, which activated the natural killer cells and also somehow improved their glucose response, probably in addition to many other beneficial effects. As Cousins said of placebos back in 1979, the process works not because of any magic in the tablet, but because the human body is its own best apothecary, and because the most successful prescriptions are filled by the body itself. Inspired by Cousins' experience, and with alternative and mind-body medicine now in full swing, Yale University surgeon Bernie Siegel started to look at why some of his cancer patients with poor odds survived, while others with better odds died. Siegel's work defined cancer survivors largely as those who had a feisty, fighting spirit, and he concluded that there were no incurable diseases, only incurable patients. Siegel also began writing about hope as a powerful force for healing, and about unconditional love, with the natural pharmacy of elixirs it provides, as the most powerful stimulant of the immune system. The profusion of new antidepressants that appeared around the late 1980s and into the 90s would next ignite a controversy that would ultimately, although not immediately, increase respect for the power of placebos. In researching a 1998 meta-analysis of published studies on antidepressant drugs, psychologist Irving Kirsch, PhD, then at the University of Connecticut, was shocked to find that in 19 randomized, double-blind clinical trials involving more than 2,300 patients, most of the improvement was due not to the antidepressant medications, but to the placebo. Kirsch then used the Freedom of Information Act to gain access to the data from the drug manufacturer's unpublished clinical trials, which by law had to be reported to the Food and Drug Administration. Kirsch and his colleagues did a second meta-analysis, this time on the 35 clinical trials conducted for 4 of the 6 most widely prescribed antidepressants approved between 1987 and 1999. Now looking at data from more than 5,000 patients, the researchers found again that placebos worked just as well as the popular antidepressant drugs Prozac, Effexor, Suzone, and Paxil, a whopping 81% of the time. In most of the remaining cases where the drug did perform better, the benefit was so small that it wasn't statistically significant. Only with severely depressed patients were the prescription drugs clearly better than placebo. Not surprisingly, Kirsch's study caused quite an uproar, although many researchers seemed quite willing to throw the placebo baby out with the bathwater. While most of the fracas focused on the fact that these drugs weren't any better than the placebo, the patients in the trials did, in fact, get better on antidepressants. The drugs did work, but the patients taking placebos got better too. Instead of seeing Kirsch's work as proof that antidepressants failed, some researchers chose to see the glasses half full and pointed to the data as proof that placebos succeeded. After all, the trials provided stunning proof that thinking that you can get better from depression can actually heal depression just as well as taking a drug. The people in the study who got better on the placebos were actually making their own natural antidepressants, just as Levine's patients in the 70s who had their wisdom teeth out made their own natural painkillers. What Kirsch had brought to light was more evidence that our bodies do have an innate intelligence that enables them to serve us with a chemical array of natural healing compounds. Interestingly enough, the percentage of people who improve while taking placebos in depression trials has gotten greater over time, as has the response to active medication. Some researchers have suggested that this is because the public has greater expectations for the antidepressant drugs, which in turn makes the placebos more effective in these blind trials. It was only a matter of time before neuroscientists would start using sophisticated brain scans to take an intricate look at what happens neurochemically when a placebo is administered. An example is the 2001 study on Parkinson's patients who regained motor skills after receiving only an injection of saline that they thought was medication, described in Chapter 1. Italian researcher Fabrizio Benedetti, MD, PhD, a pioneer in placebo research, did a similar Parkinson's study a few years later, and for the first time, was able to show a placebo's effect on individual neurons. His studies explored not only the neurobiology of expectation, as with Parkinson's patients, but also the neurobiology at work with classical conditioning, what Ada had been able to glimpse years previously with his nauseated lab rats. In one experiment, Benedetti gave study subjects the drug sumatriptan to stimulate growth hormone and inhibit cortisol secretion, and then without the patient's knowledge, he replaced the drug with a placebo. He found that the patient's brain scans continued to light up in the same places as when they were getting the sumatriptan. This was proof that the brain was indeed producing the same substance, in this case, growth hormone, on its own. The same was seen to be true for other drug-placebo combinations as well. The chemicals made in the brain closely tracked those that the subjects initially received via drugs that were given to treat immune system disorders, motor disorders, and depression. In fact, Benedetti even showed that placebos cause the same side effects as the drugs. For example, in one placebo study using narcotics, the subjects suffered the same side effects of slow and shallow breathing when taking the placebo, because the placebo effect so closely mimicked the physiological effect of the drug. If the truth be told, our bodies are indeed capable of creating a host of biological chemicals that can heal, protect us from pain, help us sleep deeply, enhance our immune systems, make us feel pleasure, and even encourage us to fall in love. Reason this for a moment. If a particular gene was already expressed so that we made those specific chemicals at one point in our lives, but then we stopped making them because of some type of stress or illness that turned off that gene, maybe it's possible for us to turn the gene back on again, because our bodies already know how to do that from previous experience. Stay tuned for research to prove this. So let's begin to look at how this happens. The neurological research shows something truly remarkable. If a person keeps taking the same substance, his or her brain keeps firing the same circuits in the same way, in effect memorizing what the substance does. The person can easily become conditioned to the effect of the particular pill or injection from associating it with a familiar internal change from past experience. Because of this kind of conditioning, when the person then takes a placebo, the same hardwired circuits will fire as when he or she took the drug. An associative memory elicits a subconscious program that makes a connection between the pill or injection and the hormonal change in the body, and then the program automatically signals the body to make the related chemicals found in the drug. Isn't that amazing? Benedetti's research also makes another point very clear. Different types of placebo treatments work best with different goals. For example, in the Sumatrapan study, initial verbal suggestions that the placebo would work had no effect on the production of growth hormone. To use placebos to affect unconscious physiological responses by associative memory, such as to secrete hormones or alter the functioning of the immune system, conditioning gets results. Whereas the use of placebos to change more conscious responses, such as to relieve pain or lessen depression, a simple suggestion or an expectation works. So there isn't just one placebo response, Benedetti insisted, but several. An astonishing new twist to placebo research came in a 2010 pilot study led by Harvard's Ted Kapchuk, DOM, that showed that placebos worked even when people knew they were taking a placebo. In the study, Kapchuk and his colleagues gave 40 patients with irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, a placebo. Each patient received a bottle clearly labeled placebo pills and was told it contained placebo pills made of an inert substance, like sugar pills, that have been shown in clinical studies to produce significant improvement in IBS symptoms through mind-body self-healing processes. A second group of 40 IBS patients, given no pills, served as a control group. After 3 weeks, the group taking the placebos reported twice as much symptom relief as the no-treatment group, a difference that Kapchuk noted is comparable to the performance of the best real IBS drugs. These patients hadn't been tricked into healing themselves. They knew full well they weren't getting any medication. And yet, after hearing the suggestion that the placebos could relieve their symptoms, and believing in an outcome independent of the cause, their bodies were influenced to make it happen. Meanwhile, a parallel track of studies that examines the effect of attitude, perceptions, and beliefs is leading the way in current mind-body research, showing that even something as seemingly concrete as the physical benefit of exercise can be affected by belief. A 2007 study at Harvard by psychologist Aaliyah Crum, PhD, and Ellen Langer, PhD, involving 84 hotel maids, is a perfect example. At the start of the study, none of the maids knew that the routine work they performed in their jobs exceeded the Surgeon General's recommendation for a healthy amount of daily exercise, 30 minutes. In fact, 67% of the women told the researchers that they didn't exercise regularly, and 37% said they didn't get any exercise. After this initial assessment, Crum and Langer divided the maids into two groups. They explained to the first group how their activity related to the number of calories they burned, and told the maids that just by doing their jobs, they got more than enough exercise. They didn't give any such information to the second group, who worked in different hotels from the first group, and so wouldn't benefit from conversations with the other maids. 1 month later, the researchers found that the first group lost an average of 2 pounds, lowered their percentage of body fat, and lowered their systolic blood pressure by an average of 10 points, even though they hadn't performed any additional exercise outside of work or changed their eating habits in any way. The other group, doing the same job as the first, remained virtually unchanged. This echoed similar research done earlier in Quebec, where a group of 48 young adults participated in a 10-week aerobic exercise program, attending 3 90-minute exercise sessions per week. The group was divided into two. The instructors told the first half, the test subjects, that the study was specifically designed to improve both their aerobic capacity and their psychological well-being. They mentioned only the physical benefits of aerobics to the second half, who served as the control group. At the end of 10 weeks, the researchers found that both groups increased their aerobic capacity, but it was only the test subjects, not the controls, who also received a significant boost in self-esteem, a measure of well-being. As these studies show, our awareness alone can have an important physical effect on our bodies and our health. What we learn, the language that's used to define what we'll experience, and how we'll assign meaning to the explanations that are offered, all affect our intention. And when we put greater intention behind what we're doing, we naturally get better results. In short, the more you learn about the what and the why, the easier and more effective the how becomes. My hope is that this book will do the same for you. The more you know what you're doing and why you're doing it, the better results you're bound to get. We also assign meaning to subtler factors, such as the color of the medicine we take and the quantity of pills we ingest, as shown in an older but classic study from the University of Cincinnati. In this study, researchers gave 57 medical students either one or two pink or blue capsules, all of them inert, although the students were told that the pink capsules were stimulants and the blue ones were sedatives. The researchers reported two capsules produced more noticeable changes than one, and blue capsules were associated with more sedative effects than pink capsules. Indeed, the students rated the blue pills as being 2.5 times more effective as sedatives than the pink pills, even though all the pills were placebos. More recent research shows that belief and perceptions can also affect scores of mental performance on standardized tests. In a 2006 study from Canada, 220 female students read fake research reports claiming that men had a 5% advantage over women in math performance. The group was divided into two, with one group reading that the advantage was due to recently discovered genetic factors, while the other group read that the advantage resulted from the way teachers stereotype girls and boys in elementary school. Then the subjects were given a math test. The women who'd read that men had a genetic advantage scored lower than those who'd read that men had an advantage due to stereotyping. In other words, when they were primed to think that their disadvantage was inevitable, the women performed as if they truly had a disadvantage. A similar effect had been documented with African American students, who have historically scored lower than whites on vocabulary, reading, and math tests, including the Scholastic Aptitude Test, SAT, even when socioeconomic class is not a factor. In fact, the average black student scores below 70 to 80% of the white students of the same age on most standardized tests. Stanford University social psychologist Claude Steele, PhD, explains that an effect called stereotype threat is to blame. His research shows that students who belong to groups that have been negatively stereotyped perform less well when they think their scores will be evaluated in light of that stereotype than they do when they feel no such pressure. In Steele's landmark study conducted with Joshua Aronson, PhD, researchers gave a series of verbal reasoning tests to Stanford sophomores. Some of the students were given instructions that prime the stereotype that blacks score lower than whites, by saying that the quiz they're about to take was designed to measure their cognitive ability, while the others were told that the test was merely an unimportant research tool. In the group where the stereotype was primed, blacks scored lower than whites who had similar SAT scores. When the stereotype was not primed, performance of blacks and whites whose SAT scores were similar was the same, proving that the priming made a critical difference. Priming is basically when someone, some place, or something in our environment, for example taking a test, triggers all sorts of associations that are hardwired into our brains, that people grading this test think black students score lower than whites, causing us to act in certain ways, not scoring as highly, without being conscious of what we're doing. It's called priming, because it works just as priming a pump does. You have to have water already in the pumping system in order to pump more water out of it. So in this example, the idea or belief that others expect black students to score lower than whites is like the water that's already in the system. It's just there all the time. When you do something to stimulate the system, grabbing the pump handle or taking the test, you're stirring up all those related thoughts, behaviors or emotions, and you produce exactly what was waiting to emerge from the system all along, be that water, in the case of a pump, or lower test scores, if it's a test. Think about this for a moment. Most automatic behaviors that priming elicits are produced by unconscious or subconscious programming, which for the most part is happening behind the scenes of our awareness. Are we then primed to behave unconsciously all day long without our even knowing it? Steele replicated this effect with other stereotype groups as well. When Steele gave a math test to a group of white and Asian men who were strong in math, the white men in the group who were told that Asians do slightly better than whites on the test indeed didn't do as well as the white men in the control group who weren't told that. Steele's experiments with strong female math students showed similar results. Again, when the students' unconscious expectation was that they would score lower, they in fact did. The greater meaning behind Steele's research, then, is quite profound. What we're conditioned to believe about ourselves and what we're programmed to think other people think about us affects our performance, including how successful we are. It's the same with placebos. What we're conditioned to believe will happen when we take a pill, and what we think that everyone around us, including our doctors, expects will happen when we do, affects how our bodies respond to the pill. Could it be that many drugs, or even surgeries, actually work better because we're repeatedly primed, educated, and conditioned to believe in their effects? When if it weren't for the placebo effect, those drugs might not work as well, or at all. Two recent studies from the University of Toledo perhaps shed the best light on how the mind alone can determine what someone perceives and experiences. For each study, researchers divided a group of healthy volunteers into two categories, optimists and pessimists, according to how the volunteers answered questions on a diagnostic questionnaire. In the first study, they gave the subjects a placebo, but told them it was a drug that would make them feel unwell. The pessimists had a stronger negative reaction to the pill than the optimists. In the second study, the researchers gave the subjects a placebo as well, but told them it would help them sleep better. The optimists reported much better sleep than the pessimists. So the optimists were more likely to respond positively to a suggestion that something would make them feel better because they were primed to hope for the best future scenario. And the pessimists were more likely to respond negatively to suggestion that something would make them feel worse because they consciously or unconsciously expected the worst potential outcome. It's as if the optimists were unconsciously making the specific chemicals to help them sleep, while the pessimists were unconsciously making a pharmacy of substances that made them feel unwell. In other words, in exactly the same environment, those with a positive mindset tend to create positive situations, while those with a negative mindset tend to create negative situations. This is the miracle of our own free-willed, individual, biological engineering. While we may not know exactly how many medical healings are due to the placebo effect, Beecher's 1955 paper mentioned earlier in this chapter claimed the number was 35%, but modern-day research shows it can range anywhere from 10 to 100%. The overall number is certainly extremely significant. Given that, we have to ask ourselves, what percentage of diseases and illnesses are due to the effects of negative thoughts in the nocebo? Considering that the latest scientific research in psychology estimates that about 70% of our thoughts are negative and redundant, the number of unconsciously created nocebo-like illnesses might be impressive indeed. Certainly, much higher than we realize. This idea makes a lot of sense given that so many mental, physical, and emotional health conditions seem to arise from nowhere. Although it may seem incredible that your mind could actually be that powerful, the research of the past several decades clearly points to a few empowering truths. What you think is what you experience, and when it comes to your health, that's made possible by the amazing pharmacopoeia that you have within your body that automatically and exquisitely aligns with your thoughts. This miraculous dispensary activates naturally occurring healing molecules that already exist within your body, delivering different compounds designed to elicit different effects in any number of different circumstances. Of course, this raises the question, how do we do it? The chapters that follow will explain how this all unfolds on a biological level, and thus how you can apply this innate ability to consciously and intentionally create the health and the life that you want to experience. Chapter 3. The Placebo Effect in the Brain. If you read my previous book, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, you'll find that this chapter reviews much of that material. If you feel that you already have a good command of that information, you may choose to either skip this chapter completely or skim it to brush up on those concepts as needed. If in doubt, I recommend that you read this chapter because a thorough understanding of what is presented here will be necessary to fully understand the chapters that follow. As the stories in the last two chapters illustrate, when we truly change our state of being, our bodies can respond to a new mind. And changing our state of being begins with changing our thoughts. Because of the size of our enormous forebrain, the privilege of being a human being is that we can make thought more real than anything else. And that's how the placebo works. To see how the process unfolds, it's vital to examine and review three key elements: conditioning, expectation, and meaning. As you'll see, these three concepts all seem to work together in orchestrating the placebo response. I explained conditioning, the first element in the discussion about Pavlov in the previous chapter. To recap, conditioning happens when we associate a past memory, for example, taking an aspirin, with a physiological change, getting rid of a headache, because we've experienced it so many times. Think about it like this. If you notice that you have a headache, essentially you become aware of a physiological change in your inner environment. You're feeling pain. The next thing you automatically do is look for something in your outer world, in this case an aspirin, to create a change in your inner world. We could say it was your internal state, being in pain, that prompted you to think about some past choice you made, action you took, or experience you had in your external reality that changed how you were feeling, taking an aspirin and getting relief. Thus, the stimulus or cue from the outer environment, called the aspirin, creates a specific experience. When that experience produces a physiological response or reward, it changes your internal environment. The moment you notice a change in your inner environment, you pay attention to what it was in your outer environment that caused the change. That event, where something outside of you changes something inside of you, is called an associative memory. If we keep repeating the process over and over again, by association, the outer stimulus can become so strong or reinforced that we can replace the aspirin for a sugar pill that looks like an aspirin, and it will produce an automatic inner response, lessening the pain of the headache. That's one way the placebo works. Figure 31A, Figure 31B, and Figure 31C illustrate the conditioning process. Expectation, the second element, comes into play when we have reason to anticipate a different outcome. So, for example, if we have chronic pain from arthritis and get a new medication from the doctor, who enthusiastically explains to us that it's supposed to alleviate our pain, we accept his suggestion and expect that when we take this new medication, something different will happen. We won't be in pain anymore. Then, in effect, our doctor has influenced our level of suggestibility. Once we become more suggestible, we're naturally associating something outside of ourselves, the new medication, with the selection of a different possibility, being pain-free. In our minds, we are picking a different future potential and hoping, anticipating, and expecting that we'll get that different result. If we emotionally accept and then embrace that new outcome we've selected, and the intensity of our emotion is great enough, our brains and our bodies won't know the difference between imagining that we've changed our state of being to being pain-free and the actual event that caused the change to a new state of being. To the brain and the body, they are the same. Consequently, the brain fires the same neural circuits as it would if our state had changed, if the drug worked to relieve the pain, while it releases similar chemicals into the body. What we're expecting to be pain-free then actually happens, because the brain and the body create the perfect pharmacy to alter our internal condition. We are now in a new state of being. That is, the mind and body are working as one. We're that powerful. Assigning meaning, the third element, to a placebo helps it work, because when we give an action a new meaning, then we have added intention behind it. In other words, when we learn and understand something new, we put more of our conscious, purposeful energy into it. So, for example, in the study about the hotel maids from the previous chapter, once the maids understood how much physical exercise they were doing every day just by performing their jobs, as well as the benefits of that exercise, they assigned more meaning to those actions. They weren't just vacuuming, scrubbing, and mopping. They realized they were working their muscles, increasing their strength, and burning calories. Because the vacuuming, scrubbing, and mopping had more meaning after the researchers educated them about the physical advantages of exercise, the maids' intention, or aim, as they worked, wasn't just to complete their tasks. It was also to get physical exercise and become healthier. And that's exactly what happened. The members of the control group didn't assign the same meaning to their tasks, because they didn't know that what they were doing was beneficial to their health. So they also didn't receive the same benefits, even though they were performing exactly the same actions. The placebo works the same way. The more you believe that a particular substance, procedure, or surgery will work because you've been educated about its benefits, the better your chances of responding to the thought of improving your health and getting better. In other words, if you place more meaning behind a possible experience with a person, place, or thing in your external environment in order to change your internal environment, then you're more likely to be successful at intentionally changing your inner state by thought alone. In addition, the more you can accept a new outcome related to your health, because you've been educated about the possible rewards of what you're doing, the clearer the model you're creating in your own mind, and so the better you'll be at priming your brain and your body to replicate exactly that. Simply said, the more you believe in the cause, the better the effect. If the placebo effect is a function of how a thought can change physiology, we could call it mind over matter. Then perhaps we should examine our thoughts and how they interact with our brains and our bodies. Let's begin with our own personal daily thoughts. We are a creature of habit. We think somewhere between 60,000 to 70,000 thoughts in one day. And 90% of those thoughts are exactly the same ones we had the day before. We get up on the same side of the bed, go through the same routine in the bathroom, comb our hair in the same way, sit in the same chair as we eat the same breakfast, and hold our mug in the same hand, drive the same route to the same job, and do the same things we know how to do so well with the same people who push the same emotional buttons every day. And then we hurry up and go home so that we can hurry up and check our email, so that we can hurry up and eat dinner, so that we can hurry up and watch our favorite TV shows, so that we can hurry up and brush our teeth in the same bedtime routine, so that we can hurry up and go to bed at the same time, so that we can hurry up and do it all over again the next day. If it sounds as though I'm saying that we live a huge part of our lives on autopilot, that's exactly right. Thinking the same thoughts leads us to make the same choices. Making the same choices leads to demonstrating the same behaviors. Demonstrating the same behaviors leads us to create the same experiences. Creating the same experiences leads us to produce the same emotions. And those same emotions then drive the same thoughts. Take a look at figure 3.2 and follow the sequence of how our same thoughts create the same reality as usual. As a result of this conscious or unconscious process, your biology stays the same. Neither your brain nor your body changes at all, because you're thinking the same thoughts, performing the same actions, and living by the same emotions, even though you may be secretly hoping your life will change. You create the same brain activity, which activates the same brain circuits, and reproduces the same brain chemistry, which affects your body chemistry in the same way. And that same chemistry signals the same genes in the same ways. And the same gene expression creates the same proteins, the building blocks of cells, which keep the body the same. I'll go into more on proteins later. And since the expression of proteins is the expression of life or health, your life and your health stay the same. Now take a look at your life for a moment. What does this mean for you? If you're thinking the same thoughts as yesterday, more than likely you're making the same choices today. Those same choices today are leading to the same behaviors tomorrow. The same habitual behaviors tomorrow are producing the same experiences in your future. The same events in your future reality are creating the same predictable emotions for you all the time. And as a result, you're feeling the same every day. Your yesterday becomes your tomorrow. So in truth, your past is your future. If you agree with me up to this point, then we could say that the familiar feeling I just described is you, your identity or your personality. It's your state of being. And it's comfortable, effortless, and automatic. It's the known you who, quite frankly, is living in the past. When you keep this redundant process going on a daily basis, because you wake up in the morning and anticipate and remember the feeling of you every day, in time, that known state of being can drive only the same thoughts that will influence you to crave the same automatic cycle of choices, behaviors, and experiences in order to arrive back at that familiar feeling that you think of as you. So everything stays the same about your personality. If this is your personality, then your personality creates your personal reality. It's that simple. And your personality is made up of how you think, how you act, and how you feel. So the present personality, who is reading this page, has created the present personal reality called your life. And that also means that if you want to create a new personal reality, a new life, then you have to begin to examine or think about the thoughts you've been thinking and change them. You must become conscious of the unconscious behaviors you've been choosing to demonstrate that have led to the same experiences, and then you must make new choices, take new actions, and create new experiences. Figure 3.3 shows how your personality influences your personal reality. You must observe and pay attention to those emotions that you've memorized and that you live by on a daily basis, and decide if living by those emotions over and over again is loving to you. You see, most people try to create a new personal reality as the same old personality, and it doesn't work. In order to change your life, you have to literally become someone else. Stay tuned for some sound science to support this process. Take a glance at Figure 3.4 and follow the sequence again. So if you understand this model, then you should agree with me that your new thoughts should lead to new choices. New choices should lead to new behaviors. New behaviors should lead to new experiences. New experiences should create new emotions, and new emotions and feelings should inspire you to think in new ways. That's called evolution. And your personal reality and your biology, your brain circuitry, your internal chemistry, your genetic expression, and ultimately your health, should change as a result of this new personality, this new state of being. And it all seems to start with a thought. Up to this point, I briefly mentioned terms like brain circuitry, neural networks, brain chemistry, and genetic expression, without giving you much explanation of what they mean. So for the rest of the chapter, I want to outline some simple scientific understandings of how the brain and body work together, in order to build a complete model of how you really can become your own placebo. Your brain, which is at least 75% water, and is the consistency of a soft-boiled egg, is made up of 100 billion nerve cells, called neurons, that are seamlessly arranged and suspended in this aqueous environment. Each nerve cell resembles a leafless but elastic oak tree, with wiggly branches and root systems that connect and disconnect to other nerve cells. The number of connections a particular nerve cell might make can range from 1,000 to more than 100,000, depending on where in the brain the nerve cell resides. For example, your neocortex, your thinking brain, has about 10,000 to 40,000 connections per neuron. We used to think of the brain as a computer, and while there are certainly some similarities, we now know there's much more to the story. Each neuron is its own unique biocomputer with more than 60 megabytes of RAM. It's capable of processing enormous amounts of data, up to hundreds of thousands of functions per second. As we learn new things and have new experiences in our lives, our neurons make new connections, exchanging electrochemical information with each other. Those connections are called synaptic connections, because the place where the cells exchange information, the gap between the branch of one neuron and the root of another, is called a synapse. If learning is making new synaptic connections, then remembering is keeping those connections wired together. So in effect, a memory is a long-term relationship or connection between the nerve cells. And the creation of these connections and the ways they change over time alters the physical structure of the brain. As the brain makes these changes, Our thoughts produce a blend of various chemicals called neurotransmitters. Serotonin, dopamine, and acetylcholine are a few examples you may recognize. When we think thoughts, neurotransmitters at one branch of one neuron tree cross the synaptic gap to reach the root of another neuron tree. Once they cross that gap,